Being the big vinyl lover that I am, I'm proud to tell you about Joe's Albums in their two locations. The original shop at 317 Main Street in downtown Worcester, Massachusetts, and their second location out in Western Mass at 5 Market Street, Northampton. Both of these shops are loaded with both new and used vinyl. It's hard to walk in either shop and walk out empty-handed due to their amazing collection of records and other cool goodies like t-shirts, mugs, posters, etc. If you can't find what you're looking for in the retail stores, check out their website, joesalbums.com. Thank you, Joe, for being so cool.
Time to make it right. Meet me down at
Welcome to Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. How's everybody doing out there? We started you off with the track Blankets from Blood Lightning's self-titled album just released in October by Ripple Music. Jim Healy, who is not only the lead singer of Blood Lightning, but has been a staple in the Boston music scene for over 20 years, joins us on the show today to talk about not only Blood Lightning, but also his recent solo stuff, Set Fire, We're All Gonna Die, and more. Stick around. We had a great talk, and I want you to check it out. Okay, a couple episodes ago, I had mentioned that longtime Gangrene roadie and music fan Dean Jackson had passed away. Well, our friend Gangrene's Chris Doherty teamed up with Boston promoter Sean McNally and put together an outstanding tribute for Dean on Sunday, March 24th at Sonia in Cambridge. Wow, what a day. I'm going to try and tell you all about it right now. I picked up my friend Tom Wilson, who's been on the show a couple times, who's like well-known roadie from Boston, worked with everybody. He was the stage manager for this show. So I picked him up. We headed into town. The show was an afternoon all-ages matinee with 6 hours of entertaining performances. And I'm not kidding when I say entertaining. It was entertaining on and off the stage, by the way. I love all ages matinees, and I've mentioned many times in the show, and this was no exception. This was one of those great Boston shows where every time you turn around, you know someone in the room. Boston has always had a long tradition of bands supporting other bands. Everyone basically who was a hoo-hoo, not everyone, but a lot of people that were hoo-hoos, hoo-hoos in the Boston music scene were at this show. I'm telling you, every time you turn around, somebody you knew was there. At least somebody I knew was there. It was great catching up with so many people. TJ Welsh and the Wasted, who were nice enough to supply the backline for this show, started things off. They were followed by Spectacle, our good friend Paul Fox, Barroom Heroes, Florida's Gusto. I mean, that was just the beginning of the show. That was a show in itself right there. Things really started to pick up when Richie Parsons, billed as Richie's Kids, took the stage. He was accompanied by Rick Jones of Jerry's Kids on bass, Spiller's Jack Clark on drums, and Doug Harper on guitar. They blew the roof off the place when they played a cover of La Peste, Spy Master. I mean, you could play Spy Master anywhere at any time, and the crowd would go wild, but his version was fantastic. And the guys backing him up, great. Bob Sensi of Jerry's Kids then took the stage, and before long, we're looking at a full-on Jerry's Kids reunion, minus Brian Betzker. The set started with the FU's Bob Ferapples on drums and Bob and Rick Jones. And before long, Jack Clark was on drums and original Jerry's Kids singer Brian Jones was on stage, and the place went absolutely wild. At one point, SSD singer Springer, that's right, Springer, who was the MC for the show, and I have to say he did a really good job. He jumped on stage and joined Bob and Rick for an energetic cover of the Dead Boys' Sonic Reducer. Got to tell you, man, Springer still has it. He was great. I mean, I can see an SSD reunion happening down the road. I could see it. The singer definitely can sing still. It's incredible. The whole band is going to be great if they ever do that. I hope they do it. During the set, I was almost nearly killed when a stage dive by one of my friends, and I'm not mentioning his name, dislodged my cell phone from me while I was recording. And there is plenty of proof of that on YouTube, TikTok, wherever you want to look. Just go to @TwistedRico and you can see what happened. It was crazy. I think it got posted everywhere by a lot of people. What a moment. As if that all is well, though. I didn't get hurt. Someone did get it slightly injured, but I'm hoping he's all right because it was a manic moment for sure. Then the FUs took the stage and destroyed the place. With all due respect to everyone that played that day, they had probably the best set of the day. And that is not to meant that is not meant to take away from the other bands, because there were tons of killer performances, but the FUs really had it together. You can tell they've been playing a lot. And they played Young Fast Iranians, one of the best songs ever to emerge from the Boston music scene, and they crushed it. Tree then took the stage, and Dave Tree was in top form with his new lineup. They put on a great performance as well. He was giving money out to the audience at one point. Dave Tree, what a trip. He's coming back to the show, by the way. We're trying to figure out how to get him on Zoom, because he doesn't Zoom, but we'll figure it out. This all led us to Chris Doherty and Gangrene. And Chris brought tears to my eyes when he talked about his lifelong friendship with Dean, and then proceeded to deliver a great set. Okay, the highlight for me was Out on the Couch from Another Case of Brutality. I wasn't expecting to hear that. Fantastic. Also played Another Wasted Night, Let's Drink Some Beer, Voice is Scary, and on and on. It was a great set by a revamped version of the band. And Chris really made me laugh, and he made me cry at the same time. What a show. And if you weren't there, you really missed it. If there was a way that Dean Jackson could have watched this from wherever he may be, I'm sure he was happy to see his friends deliver an incredible afternoon of punk and hardcore. It was really something. I just wanted to tell you about that. All right, let's shift gears now. Get heavy, and I'm going to play this conversation I had with you with the very talented songwriter and musician, Jim Healy. So sit back, open your ears, and enjoy. Welcome to those of you watching on YouTube. This is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. If you want to hear this entire show with intros, outros, and music, please go to Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Amazon, etc. Please welcome to the show, Jim Healy.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing all right.
I got to tell you something, because it got me. Took me a little while to get on here. I saw this clip and I started watching it. Kirk Hammett was showing a riff to Michael Schenker, and he showed him the riff. Right? I don't know if you saw this, but he showed him the riff, and then Schenker played it, and then they took turns on the lead, and Schenker destroyed him. I didn't even realize. Wow. I mean, I was, you know, I listened to UFO and Michael Schenker Group, but he's like got to be like 70 at least, and he still wails.
Kirk Hammett is one thing, and he does one thing well, but he's, I would say, overrated a little bit. There's a funny video of actually James Hetfield trying to show Kirk a riff that he can't get, which is really funny. But yeah, Schenker blows him away. Absolutely.
It was just funny because he learned the riff in like 2 seconds. I saw it on Instagram or something. It was really incredible. And also, before I forget, because I might, your wife, Amy Bennett.
Yep.
Awesome. We've known each other for a while. We worked together on projects. She was at PolyGram. I was at A&M. And because a lot of our alternative acts back then like crossed over and were regional, I got to know Amy really well. She's awesome. Just want to get that out there.
Thank you. She is amazing. She's fantastic. I actually try to tell her. Sorry, hold on 1 second.
I lost you for a second, but I think you're okay now.
Yeah, I'm trying to just get back on my screen here. Hold on 1 second. Sorry about that.
My phone rang. I'll just talk about Amy some more and how awesome she is. We were actually in the same office for a little while when I was in New York. Her and I both were in the Boston and the New York office. Now I can't remember. I think we were together in New York. Yeah, we were together in New York.
Yeah, she did. She spent some time. So it's funny just trying to, I've hit her up a bunch of times. Well, you know, just trying to get her she had worked with Soundgarden at one point doing something or other. And I'm a huge Soundgarden fan. And I was just like, tell me about them. Are they awesome? Were they cool? And she was like, yeah, you know, whatever. And I'm like, so don't get much, you know, I mean, obviously if you're, I think in that line of work, it's probably part of your job not to be starstruck, and I'm sure at that point in time they weren't really any, you know, that was part of the beginning of their career anyways. But
yeah, I was I worked at A&M, so Soundgarden with ours. But I'll tell you, the people at the branches, and she worked at a branch, it was really important for us to sell records in regions. So when artists used to go to the branches, they did the heavy schmooze. So she probably hung around with everybody, you know. I hung around with all the A&M people, you know, and then but she had like Island and Mercury and all these other labels too. But hi, Amy. So Jim, you've built an incredible body of work with We're All Gonna Die, Set Fire, Black Thigh, the stellar Blood Lightning album that came out last October. We're going to talk about that. And, of course, all your solo work. I want to go back a little bit. I hope you don't mind if we go all the way back. Like, where exactly did you grow up?
I grew up in Dorchester, where I live now. So I was born in Scranton, Pennsylvania, but I only lived there for 3 months. So I'm more or less a Boston guy from the get-go, from about 3 months old. So I've been in Dorchester since, like I said, my 3 month old birthday or whatever. So so I've been here, I've lived in a few different other places over the years. Like I lived with Amy in Salem, and I lived in Quincy for a bit. But pretty much a Dorchester guy, believe it or not.
You've seen a lot, because Dorchester's really gone through a lot over the years.
I was a Boston public school busing kid back in the day, and on the showing my age, but I went through that whole stuff in the early 70s and everything. So yeah, seen definitely seen Boston in a bunch of different iterations, I suppose.
So since you went to the other parts of Salem and Quincy, but you ended up back in Dorchester, you must feel really comfortable there to go back there.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like this house that I'm in now is a house that, my mom, bought like back in 1980. So like, yeah, I definitely, comfortable in the neighborhood. And it's like, the part of Dorchester that I'm in actually is kind of butts up against Quincy Milton-esque, so it's like like right in 93, so it's a nice neighborhood, and definitely feels like home.
Nice. Do you remember, like, when you were growing up, what music you started listening to when you were younger?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, I suppose like anybody growing up, you're going to be first introduced to your parents' music. So your parents, and there's my cat. Yeah,
I love when cats make appearances. Mine's sleeping in the other room right now.
Yeah, that's Hattie, which just had to get on camera. And my dog Drew was at daycare today, so we don't have to listen to him crying behind me. So you get introduced to your parents' music, and my folks had my grandfather actually used to work for KLH, so we always had pretty good decks at home, pretty good stereo systems, because KLH back in the 60s was pretty good system. So we had this KLH kind of suitcase thing that we had set up, that's where, and I still have it actually, that my dad and my mom would listen to records all the time, and I still have as part of my record collection their record collection. And it was a lot of Righteous Brothers, Moody Blues, Janis Joplin, Jefferson Airplane, some Zeppelin, Tom Jones, Roger Whittaker, like really weird, like kind of all over the place. And then they eventually got to the point as the 70s moved on, they had some old Bee Gees stuff, but then they got some of the disco Bee Gees stuff. And I am unabashedly a huge Bee Gees fan. Absolutely love them.
Wow, really?
Yeah, absolutely. All of it. I think they get maligned because of the whole disco thing, which is dumb. Disco is just music. It's just dance music. So, so there was a lot of that going on. And I think one of the bands I latched on to early and got really into was the Moody Blues, because my dad had a lot of their kind of earlier stuff. And that's probably the first band that I kind of went deep and would save up money and buy their records and sit and listen to their records and look at the gatefold and look and see, like, oh, Justin Hayward plays like, Loot and 12-string guitar and mandolin and regular guitar and this, that, and the other thing. So there was just like 8,000, you know, different instruments he would play and just be like enamored by like how talented these people were, that they could play all these instruments and how deep, and their, you know, their records were like kind of trippy as, you know, as far as like, you know, mainstream, I guess I wouldn't really even call it prog music, but you know, that Moody Blues stuff was a little bit out there. So it was kind of cool. You know, there's some Beatles as well. I think the only Beatles album that they had was Rubber Soul, but still listen to it all the time. Another day that I'll always remember, this is obviously when you're first hearing music for the first time, in 74, my dad came home from Lechmere with Dark Side of the Moon.
Oh,
and I remember hearing that for the first time, being whatever, 5-6 years old or whatever, and listening to that album, being like, wow, you know. And so, yeah, I think that was like my real introduction. And obviously, too, whatever you're hearing on the radio at the time, too, any, you know, like top 40 hits and that stuff, you know, you kind of, I mean, kids in general, I think the human condition is to be tuned into to music. Like, you know what I mean? You see, just from an early age, you hear stuff and you want to dance or move, or it interests you, or kind of picks your mind to a degree. So
I wasn't expecting Bee Gees and Moody Blues, but those are good ones, man. I love both those groups, actually.
Yeah.
And your brother Scott's a musician too. So is
he is drummer. He is younger than me. He's about a year and a half younger. So we were both really introduced to, you know, we were introduced to our parents' music, and that's kind of how we, our tastes were shaped, so to speak. And it happened in around our 12th birthday. You know, the old Sears catalog used to show up around Christmas time, and we always had an acoustic guitar kicking around in the house, a couple of them actually, but my folks didn't really play. It was more, I think in the 60s was probably just a thing to always have a guitar like in your house or whatever. So someone comes over and you just strum on stuff. And so we were always, you know, kind of banging on that or making fake guitars to play and play along to Moody Blues songs or whatever songs or whatever songs that we, you know, old Kink songs that we liked or whatever. And he, you know, one Christmas was just like, you know, in the old Sears catalog, you'd have the Les Paul copies, you know, Les Paul custom copies. And my cousin and I each got one of those, and my brother got a drum set, and that was kind of the beginning of things.
How old were you when that happened?
About 12.
12. So did you pick up, was the guitar easy for you to pick up right away, or did it take you a little while of, you know,
well,
play?
It was those things that, like, you know, you immediately want to know how to play, but you don't understand the concept of, like, even what the instrument is, how it works, how you tune it, how it's supposed to sound, amplifiers, you know, you just basically draw this point A to point B. Like, I have this now and I want to sound like Billy Squire. You know what I mean? Like, I want my guitar to sound like this. So my folks kind of figured, like, we had the stuff in the basement and we would just kind of go and, you know, goof around and try to learn like Devo songs or whatever. I remember one of the ones, Mexican Radio by Wallabuda. We tried to learn that at the time. In Fields Corner, there was I'm assuming these dudes were in a band, and they had like a little kind of storefront that they had rented, and they were doing lessons. And they basically like had their own instruments there. And we went there, and they were like, you know, it was that these dudes, they were really nice guys. And they would be like, listen, you know, like, and kind of just try to teach us like the basics of like, okay. And they're like, okay, well, we got three guys here and two of you playing guitar and one is playing drums. We need a bass player. And I was like, I'll play bass. So I switched to bass at that point. And bass for the most part for the next, you know, probably 15 years was my main instrument. But then I remember the first song we learned was Billy Squire. I know I'm going to blank on the song.
Stroke Me.
No, the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Everybody Wants You.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Billy Squire.
So we learned that. Yeah. So we learned, you know, they taught us that riff. And it's funny, they would teach us the riff, and be like, you know, and my brother would be playing just, you know, and we'd just be doing the main riff. We weren't doing the whole song, but I still remember that first time that we were like, it's like the training wheels come off of a bike and you're riding the bike for the first time. We were actually playing together and it was like a song, you know, we were playing that. And as we did that, the two dudes would go in the other room and smoke weed. Basically, you know, just kind of like, all right, these guys got it, now do whatever, we're gonna go, you know, take a break. But yeah, that was kind of beginning of it, and that's kind of like, you know, once that epiphany, that's like, this is the thing that like I want to do forever, you know. And in that feeling, like I said, like the first time, like the training wheels fall off the bike and you're actually, you know, making music and making a cohesive thing with two other people. So it was really really cool.
You've been writing songs for like over 20 years. I mean, was the songwriting, did that come quickly or did you do covers? I mean, what was there a first band and what was that all about? Was it covers or were you writing your songs?
Well, interestingly enough. Yeah. So interesting. I didn't really, the whole bands that I was in, I played bass. So I was kind of more like, looking at things from like a bass perspective. I wasn't really writing songs at that point. Like, cause I kind of, at that point, like where we, my brother and my cousin and I did that stuff, they kind of by the wayside and started doing other things. And I continued with it and I joined, I remember my first, it was a band I was in called The Overlooked, and we practiced in Dorchester Heights in South Boston up on, I think it was G Street. And in a sub basement of this old house, I remember, but it was four of us. And I think around that time I was maybe 14 or 15 or something like that, and really had gotten into U2 and was really like, you know, just approaching things more like just like a bass player, like I'm playing bass. So I really wasn't of the songwriting process yet. That hadn't really kicked in. That didn't really kick in till after that band, around the time I was about 19 or 20, maybe 20, there's a band called Naked Age that I was in, that we did some stuff. And, you know, that was kind of like what I consider like my first real band, because we actually did a little touring, played South by Southwest. We had,
you did.
Yeah. Had in, like in 92, we had like, we actually, funny story, a showcase for a bunch of labels, and we played with, it was us, this band Greta, and this band I Mother Earth and Greta both got signed. We had all major labels pass on us, but we had a small indie that came up to us that said, hey man, we'd like to sign you guys. That small, and we were like, you're an indie label, we really wanted to be with a, you know, bigger label, a small little label called Interscope. Yeah. So, and you know, every musician's got that story in their back pocket, I'm sure, of like the dumb move that they made. So, yeah. So, but that was really the first band. And I think in that band, I started to more about songwriting, but it really wasn't until I stopped playing bass. Cause I went through a bunch of, so after Naked Age, I was then in a band called Big Red Crush. I played bass, and it was a band called Grip where I played bass. And it was a band called Decom where I played bass. And finally, when I got tired of being like the bass player in the band and said, I've probably not unlike drummers or other people, and said, I'm going to learn guitar and I'm going to start writing songs and singing. And that was 98. And that was with We're All Going to Die. And that's kind of where
Decom, that wasn't Eric Thaler's Decom, was it?
Yes, it was.
I didn't know you played with Decom. Were you in
Bob Mayo was in it originally, and then I replaced him. And then I want to say, after I left or was thrown out, I can't remember. It was I want to say maybe Rob Lohr, because he was in the band too. Moved over to bass, I think.
Yeah, I helped them a little bit around. It was the late 90s. It was right when I had moved to Boston. I was still working for A&M. I got robbed in New York, so I moved to Boston, and then I started working with bands, and that's when I decided I wanted to try and manage bands, you know, which is, you know, right. Not the easiest thing. Was Scott with you in Naked Edge and those other bands?
Well, so that was kind of like the full circle moment with We're All Gonna Die, is that when I left decon, and I said I want to do this other stuff and, you know, play guitar. My cousin Russ ended up playing bass, and my brother Scott started playing drums, and that was the first. And I was kind of like, hey, I've, you know, this is kind of full circle to when we first started playing. And so we did that for, I want to say, We're All Gonna Die, from like 98 to maybe 2000. Well, we did a reunion thing, but I mean, I want to say I ended up to bed around 2009, 2010, and then started doing Black Tie at that time. So
yeah, you had four studio albums. I was
Under Dogma and Out of Virginia. They were awesome. I can't say enough nice things about those guys. We put those guys out of fucking business, unfortunately, when we did a tour with Diamond Head.
Diamond Head, the British.
We did a tour with Diamond Head, Ireland, in 2007. It was us, this band called the X Brothers, which was what's his name, Bouchard, the bassist from Blue Oyster Cult.
Oh wow.
And Hilfiger's brother was playing bass in that band. So it was why can't I think of his first name? But anyways, it was a weird tour. It was awesome, and it was great. Touring with Diamond Head was amazing. At that point, I think Brian Tatler, who is really only original member of the band, anyways, and has been for years, but he was what a sweetheart. What an amazingly nice dude. We met his folks. We met it was crazy. But Under Dogma, we had done our last record, Kiss the Ground, Curse This Guy. They not only paid for that, they paid for us to get over there. And it was, you know, while it was great and it was amazing, we weren't recouping any money. And unfortunately, it kind of put them.
That was a tough time, man.
It really was.
2004, 2003, 2004, all the way to like 15, even. Just a difficult time. The record industry collapsed, and there was just not. But you seem to get embraced really well. I saw We're All Gonna Die a long time ago. I didn't know about the previous bands, but I was going to ask you, how did you fall into the Boston scene and get, because you used to get on all these, I think you guys were like with Quintain and bands like that around that scene.
So interestingly enough, Quintain's first show was with my band Grip that I played bass in. I wasn't the original bass player Grip. And that was John Swihart too, that was in Decon, John Swihart, the guitarist. He was in Grip. That was more or less his band. And in Quintain, we remember it was a Metal Wednesday at Axis. It was Quintain opened up for us, and that was their first show. But we were like around the time that we started, I want to say it was like 98 that We're All Gonna Die started, and we didn't really, I think, start doing, you know, getting better shows and doing other stuff. But I mean, you know, we played a lot, like maybe 2000, 2001. And then Under Dogma signed us in 2003. And that's when we kind of had a little bit more stuff going on and, you know, some touring and stuff that kind of, I mean, the scene back then, I mean, I've seen, you know, anybody my age, your age or whatever, has seen so many different iterations of the scene and what it is now, and what it was at one point, and just how it just changed. You know, there's definitely like, you know, this time to this time, and this time to this time, and this time to this time.
Yeah.
And no matter how you slice it, when, you know, I'm 55 and I look back and I say, I remember back in the day, and it used to be so much better, and there used to be so many clubs, and the people used to go to shows. It sounds like sour grapes, and it sounds like you're looking back with rose-colored glasses, but it's I do think it was better. It in some ways. I do think just the music industry was better. And just, there's no commercial radio. There's no what I mean. It's like it's literally this cutthroat, every man for himself, every man, woman, and child for themselves. Like you just, you know, and can you be slave to some type of algorithm or whatever? And it's just not even. It doesn't even make sense to try to play that game anymore. You know, you do, you know, music kind of for yourself, and hopefully fall into a situation like, you know, with Blood Lightning, that you're playing with dudes that you like, that you've known forever, that are your buds, and have a label like Ripple put the record out. So yeah. You get some ears on it, you know, which is cool. And I think that's, you know, that's all you can kind of hope for nowadays, but it's definitely, you know, things have changed.
They certainly, I was looking through your whole discography and I know you did a lot of stuff as time went on with New Alliance guys. And it seemed like, you know, Benny over at Mad Oak and Ethan and John Tapp, the We're All Gonna Die stuff. Where did you do it? Was that all New Alliance also?
So the We're All Gonna Die stuff originally, I want to say we did maybe 3-song thing up in this place in Haverhill that Sully from Godsmack owns with this guy Creed Dew that we knew back in the day. And it was like our first time in the studio, and it was an absolute, like, you know, I can look back on it fondly now and be like, whatever, but this was just like, you know, we're in the studio, we're hammered, we're trying to do whatever, you know, it wasn't the greatest experience, but you know, we did that. Then we had some buddies. I worked at E. Wurlitzer's over on Mass Ave in the early 90s to maybe early 2000s. So I had a lot of Berkeley friends because we were right next to Berkeley there. And a couple of buddies recorded. We were able to record for free in Berkeley, kind of like nice. As some projects. So some of the earlier stuff and some of the tunes that ended up on Go to Hell were recorded there. So Go to Hell was kind of like this mishmash of stuff recorded here, stuff recorded at New Alliance with Andrew Schneider, like in the late 99 or 2000.
That's what I was going to ask you. I was wondering if Schneider was the one that you started, or you go back to Mud Rock.
No, it was Schneider, and it was, and I want to say, I don't know that, I forget who who was helping him on that. I don't
Schleicher,
think it was
Ethan. Nick. There were a lot of guys.
I don't know. It was Ethan. I know Ethan and Andrew were thick as thieves back at that time, and he did a lot of stuff with it. I'm not sure if he did that one, but I remember that was really, I feel, that band, like the first real good recording that we did with him. We did 3 songs with Andrew, and it was, you know, he was awesome, and the stuff sounded great. But that, so it was kind of a patchwork with Go to Hell, the first album, and we had released it ourselves, and then the label re-released it, and we, you know, remixed it and blah blah blah. So that was kind of like I said, some of the Berkeley dudes and Andrew Schneider for the most part for that record. And then when we moved on to Wreck of the Minot, that we had started with, like, I want to say John Lammy worked on that. That was at Mad Oak, the old Mad Oak, and that was with, I want to say John Lammy was doing some of the stuff. Who else? And then something happened with Lammy. He had to go on tour. He wasn't available anymore. So, John Heatley actually had done some of the tunes with us
John
as well.
Heatley.
He was actually, John Heatley was, well, yeah. So he's, you know, now half cocked coming back for the Rumble. So I've been buds with John for years and years and years. So he did some of the stuff with us. And then I want to say we kind of ended up in a situation where Lammy couldn't finish it. So Ethan, Craig Riggs was like, oh, you should meet this guy, Ethan DeSalt, who came in and finished that record. And that's kind of, that was maybe 2004 or whatever. And that's kind of where I really met Ethan, and we've been kind of best buds since then. So yeah, he finished that, and then he ended the next record. He did the entire record. That was probably the only like cohesive, like we went into the studio front to back and did the whole record with him.
Around 2010, you started recording a lot of solo stuff. You did a lot of that with Ethan too, and John Taft. And your sound to me is very, I mean, it's very Seattle almost. I mean, I hear your music. Mm-hmm. I hear, you know, you could say Zeppelin too, but Alice in Chains and Soundgarden. And it's always been that heavy sound, but really good songs and good songwriting. Were you trying to change it up a little bit when you started doing the solo stuff? Because it seems like you've gone in a circle.
Sure. Yeah, no. The solo stuff really kind of came out of a couple things. Last I always write on acoustic anyways, even if I'm writing heavy stuff, just because it lends itself to, like, I'm sitting on the couch and I'm playing my acoustic guitar, and then, you know, you could, I think that any, you know, song riff, whatever, worth its salt, you could usually strip it down and play it acoustically and it'll still sound
Yeah, I
good.
agree.
So I've always been unabashedly a Zeppelin fan, unabashedly a Soundgarden fan. You know, and one of the things that both of those bands did a lot was, like, kind of weird alternate tunings to kind of change the voicing from, you know, standard, or just drop, you know, drop tuning to, like, I play almost totally all the time in Dadgad, which is, you know, one of Page's big things. So they think Kashmir, think, you know, the, like, those. So, like, it's kind of, you know, an open-esque tuning. So I would always write acoustically, but some of the stuff started being more acoustic. Now, a lot of albums that I liked in growing up, local bands like Only Living Witness, I was always a huge fan.
Yeah.
And their records, I always enjoyed the fact that they would have these, like, just crushing tunes, and then, like, these, like, kind of acoustic-y interludes and stuff. And that was all, you know, Eric, apparently, Eric Stevenson, but, and, you know, and I guess he went on to do more stuff like that and Hank Crane later on. But, like, you know, I always thought that was, like, that's brilliant. That's, like, that's because this whole, to be heavy, it's great to make aggressive music, you know, I look back and I made more aggressive music obviously when I was younger, but it's kind of, you know, I feel like it can become a little too much. You know, I worked at O'Brien's for years. I'd have to sit through a 5-band set of you know, bass drum triggers and death metal for whatever, and you're just like, kill me, you know what I mean? Like, you need some to be mixed up a little bit. So I always thought that was,
I was going to say, what you're talking about sounds like the way Led Zeppelin did it. You know, they always went from real heavy to real soft a lot.
No, and that's what I mean, like the light and dark and all that stuff. And I always liked that. I always thought it was great. I always thought Soundgarden had a good handle on that as well, too. Like, these albums, like, you can have, like, it's not this, like, one guitar tone the whole song. I mean, the whole record. One drum sound the whole record. One thing. Like, you got to kind of, like, treat each thing piece individually. So back to the original question, a lot of the stuff I was writing on acoustic ended up being more acoustic and not translating to heavy stuff, and because of that, a couple of the songs on the last We're All Gonna Die record, Kiss the Ground, Curse the Sky, were acoustic jams, which I stand by. Now, unfortunately, by that point in time, we had maybe a couple of magazines looking at us, and they're like, we're all going to die. Look at all these skulls and this, that, and the other thing. And what the fuck are these acoustic songs doing on here, you know? So it was like, it is what it is. But by that point in time, I had kind of songs that didn't fit the heavy music dynamic. I also was going through a breakup with someone who I'd been with for a long time and was like, writing cathartic sad tunes, and music at that point kind of changed for me, because the only real emotion I was dealing with a lot, like any, you know, any aggressive music, is anger, you know what I mean? So your anger, this and the aggression and blah, and it became sadness all of a sudden. And when it becomes sadness, you're like, what do I do with this? And then that, if you really sat in it, it would translate to a song. And then when that song came out, you kind of almost felt better. Like, there was a catharsis to that, like, whoa, like, I actually felt this emotive thing come out, and I put it on, you know, it's been recorded and I can still feel it. And maybe somebody else will be able to feel that too. So I think that a lot of those tunes kind of came out of that. And that's kind of where my songwriting, I thought, grew a little bit, like maybe leveled up from,
yeah, so you write more, like, out of you're one of these guys that writes more out of emotion than forcing yourself to write songs. I imagine you probably feel something and then you write it.
It has to be that way to me. I mean, I feel like the idea of, like, writing songs, like, to pander to a particular, or to try to, you know, not that I can't, like, if someone's like, here's a gun to your head, write a song, sure, I can write it. It's probably gonna be shit, but it's gonna, you know, I can write it. But I think the songs that are that resonate most with me are the ones that come out of like I feel a certain way or whatever. And that's a blessing and a curse, because you know there's other people out there that are prolific as get out, because they're like, I just write, I don't self-edit and I write 8 million songs and I have 8 million songs. Whereas like, I'm like, well, you know, I'd really like to have another album by this point in time, but I haven't felt compelled or it hasn't struck me. So that's kind of, you gotta walk the line between that to almost dig for it a little bit.
During that period when you were doing a lot of solo stuff, that's when Black Thigh, it's a hard word for me to say for some reason.
It's funny. So many people were like, Black Thigh. It's like, no, it's Black Tie. Get it? You know, and any band name that you have to explain probably isn't the greatest band name, but nonetheless.
So were you getting the urge while you were doing all your solo stuff to just be in another band? Is that what that was all about? Or,
I mean, I still loud guitar and playing more aggressive stuff, and you know, obviously with Blood Lightning, do whatever. But I mean, there's a duality, I think, to you know, there's they can, it can definitely coexist. So I definitely, one, you know, I can do a lot of the heavy stuff and then be like, okay, maybe time for some light stuff, and I could do a lot of light stuff and be like, it's time for some heavy stuff. So it's kind of like they serve each other to a degree.
And, you know, it wasn't that much longer, well, a few years after that, that Set Fire came along. And that's when you really seemed to, like, not that you didn't have everyone's attention, but you really got their attention during that period. I was not living in Boston, but I could feel the buzz from, yeah. You know, I always liked John Taft and Benny actually is who you did Set Fire with, right?
Benny is who we did Set Fire with. Yeah. John Taft, I did one of the solo record, Just a Minute, or EP, Just a Minute More. I did that with him. I did the original, you know, most of it with Ethan, most of my solo stuff, and then one with John Taft. So, but Benny was definitely, when we were doing, we had used Benny in Black Tie. And so when Set Fire came around, Ethan was out of town anyways, too. He was in Dallas, yeah. So, but we had wanted to use Benny because, you know, obviously we love Benny and Benny's does great work. So we went in, and that was something, it was interesting because we and I had known each other since maybe about the time I started doing solo stuff, because she originally, she would back me up on my solo gigs. So I would do solo gigs and she'd play piano and do backing stuff. And this is right, I think, around the time Mellow Bravo was starting. And I always enjoyed playing with her. And we got to the point where I think that she was just, you know, super busy with Mellow Bravo and couldn't do it. And I mainly would do solo acoustic shows, but I would sometimes put a band together. So it was kind of a rotating cast of like Kyle Rasmussen, Joe McMahon, Jess, Dana Fisher, Bridget Nault, so that, you know, kind of going in and out, Alec Rodriguez, like, so we would have like Ethan at one point in time, but so like different iterations of people coming in and out, but Jess started being in it less and less because she was busy with Mellow Bravo. So I hadn't played with her in a while, and we kind of caught up at one of the awesome days in, I think, 2016, I think it was. And she was doing a solo set there. I was doing a solo set there. And she was like, hey, at one point in time, told her that I had tried to do an acoustic cover of Just Like Waterwood, Mellow Bravo song. And she says, I'm going to be doing that tomorrow. Do you want to play it with me? And I was like, yeah, that'd be cool. But we didn't get time to rehearse it. So it was just basically like, I'll learn at home. She already knows it. I'll just show up. We'll get up on stage and we'll do it. And it was pretty awesome. And I enjoyed it. And it was one of those kind of like magic moments. Like I did it and I'm looking at her and we're playing and it went swimmingly. And I was just like, why am I not playing music with you again? So that kind of was the, you know, how Set Fire kind of started again. And then we start and saying like, you know, why, like, it's cool that we're doing like the mellow stuff, but let's do like some rock stuff and see what happens with that. And there was Set Fire.
Yeah, and then you caught fire. And then, you won the Rumble in 2019, and that's when, the name really got out there. And we were talking about Zeppelin before. You guys did a No Quarter, was it?
Yeah, we did. We did No Quarter. That was one of those things. Like, I remember going, seeing rumbles of yore, where, one of the things would be, a band would usually try to pull out like a pretty sick cover, like out of left field, that was going to knock people's socks off, And we had kind of messed with it, and we were like, wouldn't it be cool to play No Quarter? And, and that's a, I don't think most normal people would be like, let's cover Zeppelin song, because people are going to be like, yawn, like, you're not going to do justice to it, Now, saying, I think we did a pretty decent job of
you
it.
You did. It's a really
I think it came out great, and we kind of put our own little spin on it, and it just, and I think that I remember the first night that we played it, I think people might have thought it was a tease, and we were like, people are probably going to think it's a tease, or we're just doing whatever, but we're actually going to play, it's 6-7 minute version of it or whatever. Yeah, and it went well, and that was a fun time.
You recorded it too, right? Eventually,
we did. Yeah, we did record it. So we actually, thanks to COVID, like anything, kind of derailed a lot of bands and a lot of stuff. We had, I want to say, maybe we still have an unfinished, like, 4 songs or whatever that we still haven't, done anything with, but. Because the only one we finished out of the batch was No Quarter, and we released that. And then COVID hit, and it was, so Jess at that point, she's working in the service industry, and it was like, everybody's scrounging for money. Everybody's doing whatever. And it was just like, so she moved to New Orleans where she could be, working outside and whatever. And now, and she's loves it down there. So she's been down there for the last 4 years, I guess. At this point, but
I'm going to get a little more current now, because there are a couple of things. In May 2023, Crawl Your Way Back solo. You played all the instruments mostly with Josh Cronin.
Yeah. So here's the. So
that was a solo thing.
This was solo. Yeah. So this was supposed to be. Band we didn't mention, I'd be remiss. Was Shatner. That was in between Black Tie and Set Fire. That was with Jesse Sherman and Rob Dayball. That pictures of Shatner kind of came a little bit too, because Rob obviously stayed in there. So at the end of, once we had won the Rumble and we'd done whatever, Rob ended up going and playing with Jesus. Jess and I were playing with Josh Cronin for a little bit, but he's we didn't really play a ton of shows, because it was like right at the tail end of 2019 going into 2020. And then obviously we know what happened in 2020. So we had recorded. And so those tunes that we recorded, he actually, Josh plays on the version of No Quarter that we put out. So from the Set Fire at that point in time, Josh and I started playing. Or continued playing, and I had other tunes, and I said, all right, these might have been a Set Fire song, or they might have been, or whatever, let's form them into something else, and we'll get another bass player, and we'll call this band, will be called Crawl Your Way Back. Josh ends up leaving. So this was this kind of you could see there's kind of a line running through all of this that so at that point we had already recorded, and I said we had planned on recording it and me playing everything and him just playing drums, and then we were going to get a bass player afterwards and take it live. At that point when he left, like, okay, I'll call the EP Crawl Your Way Back solo stuff, Jim Healy. These are my tunes anyways, and we'll just put it out.
It's on Bandcamp. All this stuff, by the way, folks, that we're talking about here, you can find it all on Bandcamp. I'm pretty sure that all of it is up there. Blood Lightning.
Blood Lightning.
Okay, how do you, I want to ask you this right up front. Do you like just being the front guy in that band, like, and not having to play an instrument? Is that something you enjoy doing?
At first, no. But now, yes, because it was a challenge. It's like, I've always played an instrument and sang, and as long as I've been playing guitar, I've always played guitar and sang. So this idea of being like a front man was absolutely foreign to me. And but I've embraced it and I enjoy it and I like it. It's a challenge and it's a new thing. And now I kind of dig it, and I dig the idea of being able just to focus on singing and being able to be a focal point on stage and trying to, like engage with the audience and so on and so forth. And it's, again, this whole thing, Blood Lightning, I'm not sure if you knew how that kind of came
Yeah, I
about.
was
We
gonna,
did a
you got J.R. Roach, Bob Maloney. These are real established guys. Doug Sherman. Did those guys start playing together and recruit you? I mean, what is the story with
No, the story's actually even better than that.
that?
We're all buds, and we all, we're playing, and we all share a common love for a very maligned Black Sabbath album called Born Again that Ian Gillan sings on.
Okay,
And
you covered Disturbing the Priest on that. I'm
praise.
going to
And
talk
that is
about
kind of,
that.
and that's where that came from. We did a one-off show under the name Born Again.
Wow.
A Halloween show at Great Scott, where we did Born Again front to back.
Wow.
And man, did that hurt. singing like, trying to sing like Ian Gillan, but we pulled it off, and it was fun and it was awesome, and we had a great time doing it. And it was one of those things, because of that, it kind of had the spark, like, what would it sound like if we tried to, delve into some of these like metal that we like and try to do that kind of like, old school, like no BS metal type stuff, and write our own tunes. And that's kind of, and that was right around the time too that Set Fire was going, on hiatus, so to speak, and everybody's bands were kind of going offline, because it was right around the pandemic. And that's kind of when we were just kind of, once it was okay to get in a room together with masks and do whatever, we started going in, and we started just trading riffs over, over the internet and all that stuff. So that's kind of really where it came from.
A guy I've gotten to know in the last year or so, Brandon Baddock, he has a podcast called Disturbing the Priest. It's a great metal podcast. I'm going to tell him he needs to get you on his podcast because
Hell yeah.
I listened to the cover the other day and I was like, whoo. So, Ripple Music is a really good label. Kind is on Ripple also, right?
Kind is on Ripple, Cortez is on
Cortez,
Ripple.
yeah. You played with Scott too. Scott was in Black
Scott was
Tie,
in,
right? Yeah.
in Black Tie. Yeah, Scott's a great bud as
I
well.
love
I mean,
Scott.
yeah, there's, it's interesting. I mean, there's a bunch of us, enough old timers that have done it enough that you end up playing with most people at least one point in time, or sharing a stage with them or whatever. But Ripple as a label, and like the quality of bands that they have, and the amount of care that they actually, Todd, who runs it, is like, I can't say enough nice things about this guy. He's awesome. And it's great that he put it out, and we're stoked. And I mean, it's a, this day and age, you've got somebody that's willing to put out vinyl for you,
Yeah,
and
love it.
put a little weight behind it, and have a PR campaign, and have Decibel Magazine talk about you, and blah blah blah. I mean, that stuff is kind of awesome, So we're definitely super grateful. And like I said, like the kind, like, it's just, it's a bunch of, he's not like, he hasn't like kind of like pigeonholed himself as like, I only do stoner rock, or I only do this, or I only do that. He's just like, whatever tickles his fancy, and he feels strongly about it. He puts it out there, and you know, it's mainly heavy stuff, but there's other stuff too. My buddy Mike Cummings, you know, has some of his solo stuff out on there, and you know, there's just, I don't know. I think it's a really great label.
Isn't there going to be a showcase or something in Boston, a Ripple showcase?
Fonda, you should mention that. Ripple Fest is going to be happening. And I don't mess up the date, Jim. What is the date? it is, I want to say Saturday. I got to look at my phone here.
It's okay if you don't remember it. I'll post it anyways and mention
yeah,
the date.
Yeah, so we have basically, it's going to be
the Middle East, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's going to be in Cambridge downstairs, King Buffalo. Let's see, I've got this information right at my fingertips. Hold on one second.
While you're looking for that, I'm just going to say the Blankets video that you guys did is excellent. And if you're out there listening and you want to listen to Blood Lightning, you know, once again, you can go on Bandcamp. The Blankets video is on YouTube. Really good band with really accomplished players in it. And plus Benny recorded it, and I love Benny Grotto's work. So it's like a real good, plus the cover. I mean, come on, man, a cover of Disturbing the Priest. Are you kidding me, man? What a fucking great idea that was.
I mean, you know, that album, again, maligned because it kind of sounds like shit sonically, but like what a, and you know, it, obviously there's your you know, Aussie purists and people who love Dio or whatever, you know, I think that Sabbath is great because they do have all those different
iterations. It's Tony Iommi, man. It's Tony
Iommi.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, he's not really going to put up. So it is Saturday, May 18th at the Middle East Downstairs.
Nice.
Ripple Fest Boston, King Buffalo, Blood Lightning, Mother Iron Horse, Kind, Cortez, and Curse the Sun.
Curse the Sun, that's a good band. I got one of their records, man. Connecticut,
yeah, they're
right?
From Connecticut, yep.
Yeah. No, is Ripple, Ripple's not a Boston label, though, is it?
No, they're from California.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't think they were. So it's pretty cool that he has all these New England bands, you know, and he can.
Well, so we kind of, you know, so we took the initiative, really, us and Aaron Gray of the Middle East, who's a buddy of mine who plays in Arecu with me, bassist, is the booker at the Middle East. So he helped us get this together. So Todd is one of these people. He does his thing. He does his stuff with Ripple, but there are Ripple Fests. I want to say all over. I think there's been maybe one or two in Europe, and there's usually one in Texas. And that is usually taken on by either a local promoter or a band that's actually doing it. So we went to him and said, hey, Todd, we'd love to do a Ripple Fest Boston first iteration, see how that works out. And with these bands, and you know, do a little showcase and show Ripple love, obviously. And he was like, go for it. Like, so you know, that's why there's the Ripple Fest Boston, there's the Ripple Fest Texas, that a guy down there has done it for forever. And you know, they've always, and they're big and well way more established than the one we've done. So this is just, you know, I think kind of a bunch of Ripple bands just trying to show love for the label and for Todd.
That's going to be a good one. JimHealy.net. It's basically, you can find everything there. That's why I found everything. And a lot of this stuff's on Bandcamp. So please check it out. Jim, thanks a lot, man. Appreciate
Thank
you coming
you.
On. You really have a great body of work here. I mean, I tried to go back and revisit it all, but it's a lot, and there's a lot of good stuff. So thank you.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you so much.
All right, man.
It's great seeing you.
Start, I'll finally slow it down.
Yeah, Jim Healy, Life is a Circle. You can listen and buy all of Jim's music on Bandcamp. Well, that was a really interesting conversation. You know, I kind of knew Jim a little bit, but I didn't know him very well, but I feel like I got to know him very well. He articulated his whole life and career, music career, very well. I enjoyed that, and I hope you did too. All right, if you want to reach out to me, please write me at twistedrico@gmail.com. If you're a musician or a songwriter and you want to send music, please send it. We have an Instagram page, a Facebook page, Threads, YouTube. On YouTube, by the way, you can watch the Zoom interview that Jim Healy and I did. There's also a TikTok page at Twisted Rico where you can watch clips and other stuff. I posted a lot of videos, by the way, from the Dean Jackson tribute on the TikTok page. So please go check it out. Also, please consider supporting this podcast on your Patreon page, patreon.com, on our Patreon page, not your Patreon page. If you have a Patreon page, you know, support yourself too if you can, or get your friends to support you. That's what I'm trying to do. Get my friends and fans out there to support patreon.com/TwistedRico. All right, I don't really talk that way. All right, that's going to do it. It's going to do it this time. Till the next time we say goodbye. This is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. Keep the rock and roll alive.